Welcome back to New Books in Latino Studies. I am David James Gonzalez, the host of the channel, and today I'm speaking with Arlene Davila, author of Latinos, Inc., The Marketing and Making of a People, published by the University of California Press in 2001, and recently re-released in 2012 with an updated preface and foreword. Dr. Davila is a full professor of anthropology at New York University. Her research interests include comparative race and ethnic studies, media studies, political economy, globalization, visual culture, urban studies, and Latinos in the U.S. Professor Davila has written extensively on cultural politics, marketing to Latinos, public representations of Latinos, and the Latinization of the United States. Her books include Sponsored Identities, Cultural Politics in Puerto Rico, published in 1997, Latinos, Inc., which will be our conversation today, initially published in 2001, Barrio Dreams, Puerto Ricans, Latinos, and the Neoliberal City, that was published in 2004, and Latino Spin, Public Image and the Whitewashing of Race, which was published in 2008. Well, hello, Arlene, and welcome to New Books in Latino Studies.
Hello, excited to be here.
Well, me too. I'm excited you're on the channel. I've been waiting for this conversation for quite a while. And I was wondering if you could begin our discussion today by just telling us a little bit about, you know, your background and your pathway to becoming an academic.
Yes, of course. I'm a proud Puerto Rican, and I came here to do my studies. And I was actually working in the arts, the Latino arts, in the late 1990s, in Museo del Barrio, the Museum of Contemporary Hispanic Art, and which no longer exists. It was an incredible institution. But I joined a PhD in anthropology to do an AED with the idea that I would get more money in the arts, really, as an administrator. Mm-hmm. This was back when CUNY had open admission, allowed non-matriculated students to take classes with PhD students. And I looked at that time as, you know, what a great opportunity, because, you know, there were a lot of people in my position that didn't necessarily want to be in academia but had the opportunity. And many of us did turn into academia that way, and it was a very diverse space. And that opportunity is no longer available. I see how PhD programs have become so professionalized, and that's the big problem, I feel, because it really limits who can access them. But it was that's how all of a sudden I was bitten by the academic bug, because I felt that through my courses I was beginning to see my cultural work in these institutions more critically, specifically because I was working in the midst of multiculturalism, and a lot of the identity politics in the arts were kind of, it was a very interesting space to be working in the arts and also mm-hmm. be taking class anthropology. So that's how it all started. Then all of a sudden I got a grant to do my first my dissertation, and I continued, and that's how it all started. But it is not because I wanted to be a professional scholar, and I still don't think of myself that way. And I tell my students, you know, it's okay if you don't, you know, I think it's important to not take academia too seriously sometimes. I think we do. But anyways, that's another conversation.
Well, I appreciate you sharing with that, and I agree wholly. I think, as you mentioned, as the profession becomes increasingly, I think, you know, not just professionalized, but in that, you know, specialized, there's the potential that, as you bring up, we can become a little disconnected, I think, from those outside of the academic world. Earlier, we were kind of talking about writing, but off air, and that's, I think, just one example. At times, our writing or maybe our topical interest can become so minute that it may seem harder to the broader public to really, you know, connect the dots and see applications or connections outside of our field.
You have to always be involved with communities and with the pulse of everyday life, you know, mm-hmm. And that's such a rich space in which to be working today.
Right. And so that's how you mentioned the working on your dissertation. Is that how Latinos, Inc. began? Was this part of your dissertation project?
Absolutely. Because, you know, when I was working on sponsor identities, you know, there's a chapter there that's called Marketing and Making National Identities, because what to me was so surprising is that a Puerto Rican who grew up in Puerto Rico in the 70s in the midst of this political persecution, where, you know, it was not okay or popular to to claim Puerto Rican pride because it was seen as a sign of independentism or nationalism that was persecuted. And then to return in the 90s and kind of see, you know, when I was doing my dissertation, to see how all of a sudden Puerto Rican culture was hot, was popular, you know.
Right.
And there were festivals, and there was this effervescence, right, at the local level. And I began to realize that a lot of that was fueled by, you know, marketing campaigns, you know, that were really, at the time, you know, providing a space for cultural groups to organize around different versions of Puerto Rican identity. And surprisingly, a lot of those campaigns were developed by nacionalistas who couldn't get jobs in the government, so they just were doing this to the private sector, and all of a sudden popularizing Puerto Rican identity, you know?
Mm.
And I was curious, you know, wow, I wonder if the same thing is happening in the context of the United States with Latinos. And I was very curious because this is also the moment of the Latin boom, the late 1990s, where you have, you know, J-Lo and Ricky Martin and, you know,
hey.
And the whole... Right, and then in scholarship, a lot of people were talking about cultural citizenship and kind of like a lot of boosterism around the combination of Latinos in cultural and symbolic spaces. And I wanted to explore that, but also I always had some skepticism that, you know, that a lot of what I was seeing was more false than reality. But I knew that that marketing would be an interesting space because it was in Puerto Rico, and of course, you know, it has to be even more so in the United States. What I didn't know is whether I could access it, you know, because when you think about, you know, Hispanic marketing, Latino marketing, it's like a nationwide industry. How would you access it, right?
Right.
My surprise, you know, it was just a matter of a couple phone calls. You know, the Red Book that listed all the advertising agencies had a small section on Hispanic marketing agencies, many of them in New York City. And I just picked up the phone, and a couple people didn't respond my calls, but one person did, and she kind of opened up. I'm like, wow, what a great idea! And I was immediately. I had immediate access. There was a lot of interest from them because they felt that they wanted to be validated.
Right.
What they were doing. And also, this is also at the same time that the Association of Hispanic Advertising Agencies was coming into being. So there were a lot of opportunities for following that conference and meeting a lot of the other advertisement people in marketing nationwide, because people were getting together through conferences, through this new space, professional space. So yeah, but it all started from that one chapter in Sponsor Identities, looking at the role of marketers in fueling Puerto Rican identity. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned how, you know, the book kind of begins with establishing the basis of the Hispanic marketing and advertising industry. And a real key component, and maybe you can correct me, but maybe the primary argument of the book is, you know, the role of those people, of those within the Hispanic marketing and advertising industry in shaping public perceptions. You know, actually, right, the strong influence they have in those public perceptions and representations of what constitutes Latino identity and culture. So could you talk a bit about, you know, those people, you know, those that were involved in the establishment of a Hispanic marketing industry, what were some of their motivations, and particularly what's been their enduring influence on how we even now, you know, the public, the people outside of that marketing inteligencia, right, vision and understand what Latino culture is.
Yeah, no, there's a lot there. The Cuban contingent, you know. it's fascinating to see how these, you know, global industries, you know, have, you know, founders and pioneers, and, you know, oftentimes are born serendipitously. But in the case of Hispanic marketing, you know, it could be traced to, you know, these Cuban pioneers, many of whom had contact with corporate America back in Cuba, because they worked more or less in that industry. It's important to remember that Cuba was a very important cultural player in terms of producing television and advertisements for the Americas before the revolution. So that many of these Cuban pioneers were very versed with the idea of a kind of pan-Latinidad, because they were already in that idea for American corporate clients that they were represented in Cuba. So I highlight how many of them came to New York with previous contacts or with know-how and this idea also I talk about how, in contrast to Mexican Americans, that face incredible discrimination against speaking Spanish in public, for instance, Cubans were exempted from that experience. They came to New York with the idea, the entitlement idea that, you know, we should speak Spanish because that's what we speak, and we should be advertising in Spanish and selling this idea to corporate America, also benefiting from the civil rights struggles, you know, waged by African Americans, Puerto Ricans, Chicanos. That also opened up a space in corporate America for all of a sudden, you know, to have corporate accounts and clients and people interested in, you know, ethnic consumers, you know. So they also benefited from that, you know, not only from the previous contacts, but also the political moment where all of a sudden there was a political imperative, right?
Right.
That they also played into, you know, this idea that, you know, many of them also saw themselves as part of that movement, you know, well, we're defending, you know, Latinidad, Latinos, and Hispanics, you know, by claiming our equal space on the table. Let me think. That's really key because, you know, I talk about the kind of ironies then, you know, that were central to the foundation of this industry, because for years and, you know, arguably today, you know, remains very controlled by, you know, Latin American, you know, first generation migrants, you know, people with very low connections with global advertising industries in, you know, now increasingly from Latin America, Mexico. So you have this kind of importation of creative talent, you know, that continues apace. And I talk about this ethnic division of cultural labor and linguistic division of labor that was consolidated by the fact that the industry was so centralized and organized around Spanish dominance and the fact that, you know, we address Hispanic language consumers. So that's one of the issues that I highlight is how that the centrality of this idea of Spanish language, even Hispanic marketing, right? And I mean that the word Hispanic marketing is predicated on the notion that Spanish language becomes a dominant rationale for defending the authenticity and the justification and the existence of this industry, you know. And this was, you know, this had a lot of currency, you know. Still today, this idea has a lot of currency, which is kind of unbelievable, you know, given that, you know, the generations of bilingual and English dominant Latinos, you know.
Right.
There's still this idea that predominates today that, you know, when you're talking about, you know, Latino consumers, you have to somehow include Spanish language because even if they speak it, Spanish, you know, is what moves people. They're emotionally connected to Spanish even if they don't speak it. So it continues to feed this industry as kind of Spanish language base that then, facilitates the importation of content, importation of talent, you know. And one of the main points that I argue in the book is how this industry has ironically contributed to making Latino second class citizens twice, you know, because they're not included in the mainstream media, but then they're also not included in the media that's supposed to represent them because it's so narrowly defined around Spanish language, you know, that it reproduces hierarchies around which constituencies can be represented, but also which workers, which creative workers can get jobs, you know.
And
who cannot get jobs in that industry. I mean, things have changed a little bit there, but that has remained a big, one of the big ideas of this, that Hispanic marketing continues to revolve around.
I think that what is also interesting is the implications behind that. If we decouple, you know, the Spanish language from the basis of, you know, the most basic or foundational starting point of what identifies Latino or Hispanic culture, where then, you know, I mean, that just causes a whole bunch of questions. And I think it really is decentering in the public mindset and even in mine, you know, as an academic, one that has spoken with a number of, you know, authors in, you know, this genre, and touched on the conversations as to what identifies, you know, Latino culture and identity, and the Spanish language is pretty much always, you know, up there, you know, if not number one, number two. It's one of the primary assumptions that we associate, I think, with such a thing as, you know, this pan-ethnic, this idea of a pan-ethnic identity or culture.
Yeah, and that's also fed by the language television networks, you know, mm-hmm. and it's really important that, you know, unlike African-Americans, Asian-American, other ethnic groups, you know, racial ethnic groups in this country, Latinos from early on, you know, had Spanish Univision and Telemundo, you know, which were nationwide TV, you know, media that were crafting that idea, you know, the united, you know, Hispanidad, you know, and that's really powerful when you think about, you know, and really strengthen this industry, you know, because these Hispanic marketers, you know, could say, you know, listen, you know, you have to advertise to Latinos, and they had a space where to put those advertisements, right?
Mm-hmm.
They had the muscle of Univision, which became really powerful in fueling research and kind of homogenizing how the market would be sold.
Right.
And the parameters, you know, and I remember when I was interviewing people, everybody, of course, knew that half of that was a joke. I'm like, of course, a lot of the, you know, Hispanic marketers were very savvy, were very bilingual, you know,
right.
And to me, it was fascinating how I'm like, for goodness sake, your children are speaking in, you know, in dominant, you know, and I'm like, come on, who, you know, like, it was such the biggest joke, you know, to me, mm-hmm. it's like, I still laugh about it, you know. But it's also fed by the fact that you have this powerful media, but also, you know, it's fed by the ignorance of corporate America, you know. And one of the, you know, I think one of the most, you know, there's some funny parts in Latino Inc., you know, it's like all these stories that people told me of how, of the ignorance of corporate America and that allowed them to get away with, you know, with a lot, you know.
Right.
Because time when you could say, you know, I'm Latino, I'm Hispanic, you know, I'm Hispanics, and leave it at that. And also corporate American, you know, liked the fact that you had a justifiable, essentially authentic pitch, right? Because, you know, why should they advertise to a community that they could reach through their advertisements, you know? And here is, you know, a community that says, no, you need to advertise them in Spanish because, you know, and you know, that really justified the fact that you had an authentic, essentializing object, right?
Mm-hmm.
That could be advertised, that you could speak to, right, if you speak through them. So in a way, everybody's on the joke and continues to be in the joke, you know. By the way, it's interesting that just this past year, Univision just inaugurated Flama, which is the first English language video portal for millennials just in English. Again, it's not that this media were ignorant about English language. It's just that this group was not as profitable. You know, you couldn't sell them as easily to corporate America.
Right. There you
go. As you said, you know, like, how do you begin to evoke all these other aspects of what makes Latinos Latinos, you know?
Mm-hmm.
However, beyond language, there were other myths, and I think I talk about, you know, the nostalgia, you know, the traditional Latino, you know, the conservative Latino, you know, there was all these myths that also are bundled with this idea of the first, you know, that are very much about like first immigrant, you know,
right.
That were packaged at the time, that also fed into, you know, the family-oriented, conservative, brand-loyal Latino, you know,
right.
Which is, you know, very marketable, far more marketable, you know, than it is, you know, to imagine, I don't know, second generation or Latinos, for instance, that we're not watching these channels.
Right, and we're starting to get to exactly where I wanted to go next was the underlying ideas, behavioral assumptions and stereotypes, if you will, that undergird the definition, you know, of marketing to a Latino, you know, public, and so those stereotypes are, you've mentioned some of them, things like people that are, you know, traditional, right, conservative, Catholic, right, we've mentioned Spanish language already, family-oriented, immigrant background. All of these are powerful notions that have shaped the representation of Latinos in, you know, from those Hispanic advertisers that are, you know, selling this idea to corporate America that there's something that exists that would be a defined market, right? You mentioned that there's this desire to find a nation within the nation, if you will, something that they can market specifically to, right?
No, that's probably the nation within the nation. You know, the idea of a separate culture from the United States was so central in defending, you know, the viability of a unique market that can be contained and separated from the mainstream, you know. And, you know, it's just so problematic, too, because, you know, it lessens the total reality of, you know, biculturalism, acculturation, especially in the area of language. But again, you know, yeah, this idea was really, really powerful, you know. You know, the idea of safe, authentic, ready market. And then within the nation, you know, you have these ideas of, you know, how do you represent it visibly? Because it's our, you know, visual media, right? What ends up, you know, representations, you know, are really problematic, you know. We're still talking about the wide, wide world of Hispanic media, you know, because you have in the trope of, you know, the Latin look, you know, models couldn't be too white, but also not too dark. You know, you're not going to see Afro-Latinos, you know, in Spanish language television because, oh my God, they could be confused for African-Americans and we're selling Latinos, right? You have, you know, you Afro-Latinos maybe are either personalities like Celia Cruz, you know, people representing themselves but not representing Latinos. You know, you don't see Indo-Latinos unless it's for liability lawyers, you know, those kinds of more, but aspirational images for aspirational goods, you know, you have this, you know, Latin look that became so, you know, so hegemonic, you know. Mm-hmm. And then you have this idea, you know, the world doesn't cry Spanish, right? The idea that there is the Spanish that is more standardized and more representative of, you know, mm-hmm. that consolidation, you know, as a nation within a nation that have their own language, their own ideas, their own look, which, you know, is of course embedded in those racial ideologies too, because what we see is that, you know, we have the Mexican, more Chilango, more DF, you know, Spanish, because it's the one that people are likely to accept as standardized because of the heavy weight of the Mexican telenovelas dominating. So you don't see Dominican, Caribbean, Puerto Rican, Spanish ever being seen as, you know, as standard. So you have this kind of racial linguistic also hierarchies about which accents are supposedly more or less representative of the larger constituency. And then along with this idea, you know, all these others around, you know, the emotional Latino, you know, the Latino that is always, you know, that cares about their family, and all the tropes, you know, and when I was doing there's a lot of examples of the type of tropes, you know, a lot of the abuelitas, you know, the families, that really revolve around a kind of ethos, right? Mm-hmm. Distinguished Latinos, that I kind of, you know, what I try to do is like, what's at stake with this representation, you know, because when I was writing the book, and we still have this debate about, you know, positive stereotypes, right?
Right.
Positive or negative stereotypes, and this is an industry that positions itself as correcting stereotypes, right? Like, because we know the consumers and we're not going to do blunders, we're not going to rely on stereotypes, we really know the right way to reach that. I mean, that's their pitch to corporate America. But then what you see in these so-called positive stereotypes, you know, are more, even more problematic perhaps than negative stereotypes, you know, because they're as equally loaded in, you know, in racial ideologies and in inequalities of power. And so you have this, you know, compensating, you know, like the good family, you know. So you present this, you know, Latinos as this squeaky clean, you know, and in fact, Latino Spin, which was, you know, the book after, a couple books later, really, I wanted to analyze that more, you know, this kind of, the politics of overcompensating by highlighting, you know, this more sanitized, quick, clean, white-looking Latinos as the representation of that nation within the nation that mm-hmm. hurts. But more too, you know, because it presents us as a passive constituency, you know, aligned with, you know, conservative values.
Right.
It ignores the history of Latinos as, you know, in this country, you know, for like generations, always presents us as like forever immigrants, you know, like needy mm-hmm. of, you know, needy of our own media. And it creates a kind of segregationist view that, you know, corporate clients love because, you know, they're safe, contained, but it's not real. And it hurts us in so many ways that that I think need to be always problematized.
And I think that's a great connection that you bring out in the book. You discuss this, or talk about here is the sanitization, right? And I think that's how you depict it in the book, and that's a term you use. Yeah, but a sanitization of Latino identity and culture that goes according to these hierarchies of race and culture and nationality, and the underlying, the driving force there is this desire to create the notion again of a market that is safe. And by safe, you point out someone that's, right, consumer minded, brand loyal, also someone that can, a group that can be digested themselves and seen as non-threatening by corporate America, right?
Absolutely. This idea, don't panic, don't panic. We're more Americans than the Americans, like later on, many people, but this idea that, we're many and, we're all over the place, but, we're in fact going to not threaten America, but renew it along the values that it cherishes, which are these conservative values, we're the ones who are going to be, that are silly. It's just, it's just ridiculous. And don't get me started because, you see, I think you wanted to talk about Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz and all these characters, mm-hmm. and why they've managed to capture the imagination, of so many voters, many mm-hmm. of them not Latino, by the way. It's exactly because of that, I mean, what's Latino about Ted Cruz and Mario and Marco Rubio? They have this Cuban immigrant story, that they present as, bootstrap story, which is not true because, we have to understand the ways in which Cubans, were benefited from U.S. foreign policy and immigration
exactly.
policy. None of that gets discussed,
Right.
So they're this, squeaky clean, very white, light skin, so pale that you could even see through their faces, And it's just, anyways, don't get me started on that one, too.
Well, we're going to come back to that one, but because I definitely want to.
Oh, no.
It's so
okay.
prescient to talk about that. But again, before that, I wanted to talk. We were talking about, again, the way Latino culture is just, flattened and sanitized. So what about the role of market research, right? I mean, there is this whole idea that, corporate America is based on all these market studies and thereby there's some type of scientific component to why they are doing what they're doing. But you actually state that that's not the case, or that at least the underlying, stereotypes and behavioral ideas of, what consists of being Hispanic or Latino, which were established, decades ago, that those actually are supported by this so-called, any type of scientific analysis or research that's done. Can you talk about that a bit? Because I think that's really fascinating how, you would think again that research itself could help to undermine, those type of stereotypes that drive the main ideas behind who they're marketing to and how these representations are made. But it's really still those right, these stereotypes that have been underlying the market from the beginning.
Absolutely. And, if I'm going to tell you one big takeaway that I think I would like to learn more about, and I'm surprised no one has picked it up. And, I mean, there's a couple of research that, some students, I'm thinking of Michael Rodriguez, that, a PhD student, is looking at pollsters, and, I have a grad student here, Marcel Salas, that is looking at, research in the creation of total market, the new kind of way in which ethnic marketing is leading to. That's another conversation. But I was so surprised because, when I was writing the book, research was kind of in baby steps, right? Mm-hmm. And it was an area of great anxiety because people wonder, oh, my God, if we do research and the research begins to really highlight the complexity of this constituency, how are we going to manage it? How are we going to be able to sustain the accuracy and profitability of the market that, when the research shows that, well, it's more complex than that, right? Mm-hmm. So what's fascinating, and I'm fascinating, in exploring, the makings of research and the politicization of research and the political economy of research, and how research is very much a social construction. We give so much privacy to numbers.
Right.
And, one of the marketers told me, you know, figures lie and liars figure, you know. So many different ways in which you can do the research, and oftentimes because a lot of this marketing research is proprietary, that means that it's corporate owned and that they'll show you the results, but they'll never tell you how they got those results, the methodology, right, and how the sample was surveyed or anything.
Right.
So it's all problematic because you basically, you know, you have a whole, you know, and research is becoming more and more powerful because exactly it's so easy to manipulate and yet provide this kind of scientific idea of authenticity, rigor, and truth,
right,
you know? But this is not only in marketing, it affects pollsters, you know, it affects politics. It's become, you know, research has become, you know, the figure that, you know, where Latinos are most, you know, manipulated, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you could really say anything about Latinos because, you know, as I remember interviewing somebody at the Pew Hispanic Center, you know, who basically admitted, listen, you could say anything about Latinos because
right,
Latinos are the fastest growing, so many of us, that you could say that Latinos are rising in home ownership, are rising in Coke drinking, or rising on anything because they're always rising. There's too many of us, you know. The number of, like, the abundancy and the boosterism story in so many different ways just in terms of the numbers, but that doesn't make it any relevant, you know, any more true than anything else, right? But then that's another conversation so I highlight how research, in fact, has become, needs to be probed, and the racial politics behind the research, you know,
right,
more than ever today, especially in this neoliberal climate where we tend to value numbers and statistics and more than anything.
Yeah, and I think that's very important because there is the broader popular acceptance that, although people understand it's more complicated, there's a lot of power to the phrase that numbers don't lie, right? And that's actually not the case. That numbers may not lie, but people misrepresent, or at least there are underlying assumptions that delineate, right, that form the boundaries of how a study begins, right, where the research actually begins, right, and that's what you point to, and those are the holes that you poke in this idea of scientific market research, is that people, you know, they bring to a scientific, so-called scientific study, right, underlying assumptions that shape where the, you know, who they're going to target, what they're going to focus on, what are the questions going to be asked, what are the, you know, if there are five or six, you know, variables, what those variables are, right? And that automatically, you know, constrains, right, other possibilities and limits other possibilities, right?
The easiest example is you only sample Spanish dominant Latinos, you're going to find that, you know, Univision and Telemundo are the number one TV station for all Latinos.
Exactly.
But you sample Spanish language Latinos, you know? So that's, you know, there's so many cases like that, you know, where, you know, you have the results represented as all Latinos, yet the sample is either, you know, regionally bounded or linguistically bounded, or, you know, there's matters of class. I mean, there's so many ways in which you could cut the pie when Latinos are concerned to get what you want in terms of the results and what you're trying to sell and market.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there's two parts to, you know, the marketing and making of, you know, Latinos. There's and how advertisers try to reach them, right? There's both the attempt to reach that market that they've defined as Latino and Hispanic, and at the same time, you know, those representations extend beyond that group, right, and present images of Latinos and culture to, you know, a non-Hispanic audience. So one thing that that I'm interested in, and the book talks about, is the actual role of Spanish language programming on, you know, the TV networks we've mentioned, Univision and Telemundo. So I want you to talk a bit about to whom, that is, like, what people and to what extent do these shows, or have they influenced, right, the notions of Latino identity and culture for that target market group, for Latinos themselves, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, one of the most incredible ironies that I still don't understand is how we have a vibrant Hispanic marketing industry that sells itself on the basis of targeting U.S.-born Latinos. You know, the idea is that you can't just translate an ad from English, nor can you just import an ad from Mexico and pretend to reach U.S. consumers, that there's something different about U.S. Latinos, right?
Mm-hmm.
An industry that believes that at the same time that continues to, you know, import, you know, like place the ads in a media environment that is dominated by imported programming. And there's an idea that, well, no, it's things are different now because there's a lot of U.S.-based productions, you know, in Miami, and that is true. But oftentimes they are, you know, with imported actors and actresses and talent, you know, because within this medium of Spanish language, right, that limits the limits the content, you know. So you have now that Spanish language television has become more diverse. You have Colombian productions, for instance, you know, have productions from other parts of Latin America, but you still have that kind of imported content. And then the ads, right? So it doesn't kind of make sense sometimes. Like, how could a corporate America be so blinded, you know, that they, you know, that they buy both, you know. What's fascinating and what I've seen is that, you know, there's been a lot of criticism about, you know, the wide world of Spanish language television. You know, this past couple of years, you know, there's been incredible backlash. You know, when you may recall the big debate when the Univision anchor was the first time, because, you know, they do this all the time, you know, that they make fun, they have all this, you know, racial insensitive language and representations, and, you know, the whole brouhaha over Michelle Obama being compared to a Planet of the Apes character.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was like 2 years that led to the firing of this anchor. I mean, that was kind of huge, you know. But that was because people are saying it's enough, you know. We can't put up with this, you know. And there's now, I believe, in the Association of Hispanic Journalists. Hispanic Journalists has a task force to look at Hispanic media more carefully. But this backlash also, I think, is you know, has an historic component, because, you know, there's now a lot of, you know, Afro-Latinos, you know, and, you know, mm-hmm. indigenous movements, you know, throughout the Americas that are also criticizing the white space of their televisions, you know, the white productions and the use of blackface in Latin America. I mean, it's kind of scandalous, but there's so many comedians, you know, in Latin America that, you know, that still don blackface. I speak about this because given that there a lot of the content of the Spanish television in the United States is imported, right? There are implications, there are historic implications when we begin to talk about, when we begin to challenge this media to be to step up, you know, and at all levels, you know. So
mm-hmm.
So I'm hopeful of the moment, you know, that I think people are becoming more sensitized. People are raving about the new Celia Cruz telenovela, which I've just seen glimpses of. But that's kind of a major thing too, you know. A black woman and, you know, Cuban American. That's an incredible story, you know, that you know, we have so many stories that could be told in this medium, and not an excuse to be trafficking on all stereotypes. I don't know if this answers your question, but I think that if you know, if you're asking me what do people see and what do they learn about Latinos when they turn television, it's still very unfortunate. I mean, thank goodness Don Francisco is out of the picture, you know, but you have all these, you know, tropicalizing stereotypes,
right,
that we feed our community, you know, of like, you know, ladies in bikini and you know, white blonde, you know, you would think that Latinos are whiter than Scandinavians,
right,
you know?
Right.
You would watch television. And mm-hmm. I think that's just unacceptable, you know,
right.
And I think that there's a lot of groups and social activists on the ground that have been saying so for years, and I think that they're, some of them are finally being heard. But we need to continue the pressure, you know,
mm-hmm.
Because a lot remains to be done.
And indeed, and that's on the Spanish language side. And I know the book doesn't get too much into this, but I'd invite you to comment on it. What about how these representations play out in English language programming? Because it seems to me, just as I start to think of shows off the top of my head, the George Lopez show, they recently canceled a Cristela Alonso show, and then there are other Latina. Usually it's generally Latino, but Latinos and Latinas that are in, other English language programming. And it seems to me that on the English language side, shows tend to push the Mexican component of Latino identity and culture. But that's just things I'm thinking of off the top of my head. Can you talk a little bit about that? Maybe some of the differences, both the similarities and the differences you've seen between the representations of Latinos in, English language programming compared to that of Spanish language.
Yeah, no, and you have Jane the Virgin, which...
Right, I did, yeah. Mm-hmm.
...example that's, breaking boundaries. The thing with prime TV is, I always get so disheartened, because, we're seeing shows like Jane the Virgin and a couple other sprinkled characters, but that's so little, right? I mean, I'm sure that you've seen this report sponsored by the National Association of Latino Independent Producers that was published, I think, three years ago, perhaps, titled The Latino Media Gap. And one of the points that they highlight is that there's a huge gap in the representation of Latinos in primetime television, both in front and behind the camera, because
right.
This is also important. Talk about. We tend to think about in terms of like, do we see Latinos in television?
Right.
And an important conversation is where are the Latino producers, directors, camera people? Those are huge jobs. But this report showed that we have Latinos growing in consumer power and growing in size, so that we could now claim 17% of the U.S. population is Latino. Yet relative to these numbers, the representation of Latino in the media is like, 1%, 2%, 3%, claiming in the report that the Latinos had more primetime coverage in the 60s, in the 50s and the 60s, than relative to the number than they do today.
Right.
I think it's important, this is an important report, that it puts numbers, we tend to think we see a couple more shows, but, relative to the size of the Latino community,
mm-hmm.
We are not, we're getting peanuts, and it's important that we don't let any, Hollywood or anybody out there be misguided because they see Jane the Virgin and they think that Latinos are taking over the television. It's like, oh my God, no, like people of color. And that's like ridiculous, We need to be, 17% of all characters,
mm-hmm.
or more. Same with African Americans and people of color. We tend to think that because we have one or two or three shows that have a black lead,
mm-hmm.
when Scandal, black lead in 30 years, and people were like, oh my God, now they're going to take jobs from white actresses. I'm like, oh my goodness, first black female lead in 30 years, give me a freaking break, But we're scared of seeing people of color in the television, and when we do, they're taking over the world because,
mm-hmm.
We have naturalized this, white space, white box that only white people should come out of it,
mm-hmm.
I don't know if that answers your question, but I'm not very optimistic in anything I see, particularly because my concern has always been to not only talk about representations. One of the big points that sometimes gets lost in Latinos Inc. is this critique to the politics of representation.
Right.
Because, we tend to think that the way we address negative images is through positive images.
Exactly.
Right?
Uh-huh.
So we need...
Uh-huh.
Ridiculous, because those politics of representation do nothing as long as you have the media control, the ownership in white hands.
Mm-hmm.
And you have... Why, where Latinos are just consumers and not stakeholders,
mm-hmm.
media that is targeted to them. So we need to change the conversation so that when we talk about media equity, we're not only talking about are we seeing ourselves in television, but also are we getting the jobs, are we getting the paychecks, are we getting to vote in the Oscar deals? You know, are we getting the positions of power? Are we getting, you know, ownership, really, you know? Mm-hmm. Because we're talking about jobs and equity. We're talking about the Latinization of the entire media industry. And sadly, what sometimes research shows is that you see more images than you actually see people, you know, our involvement in the profit-making positions, and then that wouldn't be any good. You know, I don't want to see a television where you see more people of color, but it's white people who are profiting from all those images. You know, that's not good. That
right.
doesn't make me happy. That's not media equity in terms of people of color.
Yes, and this notion of equity is so important, and it gets us back to what started to get our conversation heated up earlier. But it's the point that you bring out in the new preface to the book. You mentioned this, you know, the lack of minority control and ownership of the media, Latinos' general inferiority in the eyes of corporate America, the class and racial disjunctions that exist between producers and consumers. So all of that, as you pointed out, that have actually worsened since the book was published, which, again, it was published in 2001, or now in 2015, on the verge of 2016. An important discussion that you bring about is this disjuncture between the assumptions that increasing representations or visibility of Latinos, whether you know they're white Latinos on Spanish language programming or brown Latinos or you know on English language programming, that just that visibility and somehow is going to translate to political power and representation and power, but that actually isn't the case. I'm sure there'd be plenty of those that'd be willing to push back on this by saying, as we mentioned earlier, well, we have two Latinos supposedly in the Republican, race for the presidential ticket, Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio. And so some would use that as fodder to say, well, look, you know, Latinos are making it. You know, they'd use that, they'd jump on that booster narrative and say, you know, political power is rising in that you have these two Latinos that are competing for the most elitist of positions, right? Could you speak on that for a bit?
Well, there's so much there, right? But yeah, this idea that you could single one Latino, say, oh, the Latino that made it. In this case, we have, you know, Ted, and Marco Rubio, but, you know, the same story's been made about, you know, when Ricky Martin, you know, I mean, you name it, right? You put the Latino there, look, they've made it, so why can't the others make it, right?
Right, right.
It's really, making Latinos complicit with this meritocracy, model minority myth that we know has never worked for Latinos, you know. It's very easy to be bumped from the model minority category, you know. I think I mentioned 9/11 as an example of how the boosterism, you know, like overnight, you know. I'm very critical of that discourse because, you know, I think that we're too smart to buy into it, and we have nowadays, you know, so much evidence of how that discourse has never worked, just like the politics of respectability has not worked with African Americans, you know. So I actually think that, you know, that I don't think that I don't know, I'd like to be hopeful, and I like to think that the currency of that view is kind of it's in decline. You know, when you have Donald Trump, you know, making it okay to say this kind of anti, you know, nativist and immigrant and racist, outright racist statements, you know. Last night when the Latin Grammys, you know, you had all the artists, you know, don't vote for racist politicians, you know, this kind of unifying, galvanizing space, you know. I think that what I see here is that, you know, that myth has so many holes that I don't think it stands anymore, you know. I don't think anybody buys into that myth except Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio themselves, you know. But I think that's a real minority, you know, because even what, you know, and this is something that I did in Latino Spin in my own books, and I've, you know, when people either, you know, do research with, you know, light-skinned Latinos in corporate America, you know, they too experience racism and could they could take over the mantle of model minority until the cows come home, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But they're gonna, you know, they speak with an accent. They're gonna think that they're, you know, foreigners, and they're gonna be suspect, you know. What do you belong here? They're gonna be suspected that they got there because of affirmative action or something else, you know.
Exactly.
Like
yeah.
Nobody in this context, right? No one is safe. Latinos are not safe, and I think that it behooves us to kind of engage in the politics of solidarity. That's the only way out, you know, because the politics of mainstreaming and whitewashing and white supremacy have never worked for us, you know, because some of us claim whiteness, you know, but the majority, that whiteness is suspect.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings us to another conversation of Latinos and the whole whiteness, you know, and how they are, you know, the intention to kind of like, you know, use Latinos as the kind of, you know, scapegoating for reproducing, you know, racial discourses. I'm sorry, David. I'm now rambling. I don't know what I'm talking about.
No, you're good. That's actually, I mean, that point on Latinos and whiteness, which I think is covered maybe a bit more in Latino Spin or some of your other writings, I think is certainly important because that conversation can be interpreted in a number of ways. I think typically the conversations around Latinos and whiteness revolve around Latinos making claims to whiteness, right? Trying to claim a white.
I think that the Latinos are white, you know, and how do we account for the white privilege that some of us have, but also be more skeptical about the historical, you know, the legacy of, you know, and create alliances that make us advance, you know, be agents that advance the dialogue, not agents that contribute to white supremacy, right? That's in the conversation, you know, when Latinos are concerned, because Latinos come from all hues, and while Latinos are racialized as a group, we need to really account for colorism and white privilege, right?
Right, right.
And oftentimes, you know, we don't want to do that. We're rather, oh, we're all Latinos, you know, chi-chi-ha. And I'm like, no, we also have to be very vigilant about checking in our, you know, racial prejudices and our entitlements and privileges. And then out of that recognition and spaces that we can really engage in a more fruitful dialogue that is more, that advances the conversation rather than, you know, turns us into peons of, you know, of white privilege, which is a terrible thing.
Right. Right. No, I wholeheartedly agree. And, you know, well, I thank you for speaking and, you know, taking time to speak on this book. I know the book probably seems, I don't know, like you wrote this thing a lifetime ago. We were talking a little bit before we came on air about that. But I think it's just such an important book because it raises so many concepts that questions about what we take for granted, and it, a lot of that has to do with the power of the media. Although a lot of us like to think that we don't let the media shape our thoughts, you know, when I grabbed the book, you know, just recently again and looked at it and then stared at the title for a while, it really made me question, you know, our notions of, you know, these pan-ethnic concepts. And it's not that they don't have usefulness, which I think is what your book points out to, you know, a very critical way, that they are useful, you know, for building solidarity, right? They are useful in a number of ways that can actually be empowering and strengthening, as opposed to a lot of what we get, though, in the media is really things that are produced for, you know, corporate consumption or, you know, really the benefit of a very small few. Is that right?
Yeah, with Latinos, I don't want to imply that Latinos are an invention, that they don't exist, that they're a manufacturer of this industry. Far from it. There's a history, there's a social movement feeding this identity. I wanted to question the incredible power that this industry has in defining the conversation of Latinidad and why that is, which, of course, is the result of the marginality of this group, the fact that Latinos, we don't have stakeholders and the same visibility and political power in other institutions in society, like you know, politics or academia or corporate America or any other spaces. So it leaves this industry, Hispanic marketing, as the one brokers of Latinidad that become visible, so that whenever there is, we need to find an example of Latino coming of age, right?
Mm-hmm.
We go to, you know, Hispanic marketing products, right? We go to this space to find it. And I think the best example of that was last week's, the very unfortunate HBO documentary, The Latino Explosion, which I was, you know, I died. I'm like, I couldn't watch it, just the title, you know? But if, when you look at the documentary, you know, it's just, you know, the whole argument, the good old argument, or the Columbine argument of pure come Latinos, and, you know, the examples of the coming of ages, you know, the Cuban Miami sound machine, you know, act, you know, musicians and a sprinkle of politicians, but that's all we have, right?
Right.
So it's important that we question Hispanic marketing and the marketing industry as a space that frames the conversation, but that's also part of the marginality of Latinos, and we shouldn't celebrate it, but we should question it.
Right, right. That's a great point. And I wasn't aware of that documentary that you said HBO is where it came out.
It's called The Latino Explosion.
Okay.
I know. And then you wonder, you know, this is the 21st century.
Exactly.
And we still have corporate American HBO. I mean, you're talking about representation in mainstream America,
mm-hmm.
that are like passing and giving money and funding projects like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
as well just be, you know, be backing, you know, I mean, it's just when you see that, then you realize how really far behind we are today and all the work we need to do.
Right. I agree.
So if you want to get depressed, watch it. Otherwise.
Yeah. Right. Well, maybe. I think I'm going to have to force myself and torture myself to sit through it. But I don't know. I'll probably find a time when I'm more upbeat.
I couldn't watch it. I just saw the whole, I mean, if you look at the 1 minute trailer, you kind of get the, you know, it's the same kind of regurgitated images. Then you find that. You know, that made me write Latinos Inc. Years ago. I mean, mm-hmm. that historism around the Latin explosion, it's kind of the same idea regurgitated today in the 21st century.
Gotcha. Right. Well, I wanted to, before we close up, I wanted to give you some time to talk a bit about what you're working on now.
Yes, I'm so happy. I've actually just turned in this book on shopping malls in Latin America.
Mm.
And I had a lot of fun writing it. And in fact, I think it's the book that most closely resembles what I kind of did in Latinos Inc. in that, you know, then I was immersed myself in the industry of, you know, Hispanic marketers. And for this new book, I entered the world of, you know, shopping mall developers. You know, there's, you know, mm-hmm. the international shopping malls has a vibrant regional conference in Latin America. There's a lot of developers. I even took a course, you know, in Mexico. They have a university of shopping malls. Organized by the International Council of Shopping Malls. I mean, it's unbelievable. But it's really about the ways in which the structures are reshaping both the class and spatial politics in Latin America. And I was fascinated by this industry and how it works, how it's and its effects, right? In a lot of the research is in Bogota, Colombia, but also I have a lot of comparative perspectives from the area. I'm very excited about it. It comes out in February with UC Press.
Oh, great. I'll be looking forward to it.
Yes.
Well, thank you for sharing that. And thanks again so much for taking time to come and talk about what is truly, I think, it's not old enough to be a classic, but it's definitely one of the key pieces of literature, I think, in scholarship that most of us are introduced to, whether we are studying Latino studies or media studies or, you know, cultural studies. It's just, you know, it's had a very, I think, enduring role. And the, you know, just the fact that it was re-released, you know, just a few years ago by UC Press, you know, speaks to that. So thanks again for your time, Marlene, and for coming on to New Books in Latino Studies.
Thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun speaking with you today.
Same here. Thanks again.
Thank you for tuning in to New Books in Latino Studies. I'm David James Gonzalez, the host of the channel, and I hope you have enjoyed my conversation today with Arlene Davila, author of Latinos Inc., The Marketing and Making of a People, published by the University of California Press in 2001. and re-released in an updated edition in 2012. If you'd like to get a copy of Dr. Davila's book, I encourage you to do so by following the link on our New Books in Latino Studies page, which will take you to Amazon. Also, if you'd like to contact us, please send us an email at newbooksinlatinostudies@gmail.com or feel free to reach out to us on social media through Facebook or Twitter. Thank you.